Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The Killing Season is a true crime saga, the story of a double murder that went unsolved for more than 35 years, and a chilling portrait of a small town upended by unimaginable violence. In the summer of 1975, the valley town of Grand Junction, Colorado, is stunned by the grisly double murder of 24-year-old Linda Benson and her baby daughter, Kelly. For Jim Fromm and Doug Rushing, the two young detectives assigned to the case, the investigation is a chance to earn their stripes and prove their mettle. At first, Fromm and Rushing peg the woman's mercurial husband, a pipe fitter who works outside of town, as the primary suspect. But as their case against Steve Benson unravels, the detectives find themselves short on leads and running out of time. With the city on edge and anxious for answers, a notorious serial killer goes on the lam, and yet another young woman and her children turn up dead. In The Killing Season, acclaimed journalist Alex French traces the story of the Benson murders from the night Linda and Kelly's bodies are found strewn across their second-floor apartment to an improbable discovery made more than 30 years later that enabled a new breed of detectives to crack the case and bring closure to those who'd watched justice slip away. Writing in taut, atmospheric prose, French has crafted a heart-pounding tale of tragedy, resilience, and redemption, set against the burning red vistas of the American Southwest. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Killing Season, with my special guest, journalist and author, Alex French. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Alex French.
Thank you so much for having me. How are you tonight?
Very good. Thank you, Alex, for joining us tonight. Incredible story.
Thank you.
And as we alluded to, a notorious serial killer. So people will find this very, very fascinating, this book and this story that you have in The Killing Season. Now, without giving anything away, I know that's my biggest cliche, but tell us how you came to want to write this book. So tell us how you came to write The Killing Season.
So, just about every day I kind of cruise through the, through the headlines on the AP Wire, kind of looking for story ideas. And, it was probably the spring of 2008 or 2009, I saw a news item about the story, that after 35 years, an arrest had finally been made, and it wasn't a long story, but it basically mentioned that these two detectives, Jim Fromm and Doug Rushing, had worked the case back then and had never left town, and for a long time they were sort of known as the guys who weren't solving these murders that they were assigned to solve, they had both sort of for years and years. Never really been able to get over, these crimes and sort of, in 1975 they had, 12 homicides or 11 homicides in Grand Junction after not having a single homicide there for more than a decade. And so this community was really just really sort of on a, on a razor's edge in terms of, the tension around town. And they were, they were sort of widely viewed as the guys who were letting everybody down. And that was hard on them. They were both young, were in their early 20s. And I I contacted them immediately, and they said, you know, gee, we'd love to tell our story, but, you know, we've got to do this whole trial thing, and, you know, there are appeals afterwards, and, you know, it's probably going to be a couple of years before we can speak to you. So I waited 6 years and followed the story through the trial, and then, you know, sort of, just waited and waited, and, gosh, 2 summers ago, some guys from Amazon .com approached me about and said to me, you know, if you could tell any story, what story would you tell? And I just couldn't stop thinking about Rushing and Fromm. So I contacted them right around the time I contacted them, like I think a week after the perpetrator's final appeal was denied, and they were able to speak to me. So I went there almost immediately and spent, gosh, 2.5 weeks in Grand Junction researching and reporting and knocking on doors and stuff like that.
Now, before we get into this incredible tale, let's talk about a little bit about the Benson family.
Okay.
Linda, Steve, Benson, and Kelly. Take us back, the research that you've done, and who are these people? Start off with Steve Benson, if you could.
So, you know, there's not a, you know, I don't know, you know, Steve wouldn't speak to me, I suppose for good reason. He's been through some horrible things. You know, he came from a tough family. He had a brother, Bob, and not much is known about them. I think he came from someplace in the Midwest, Indiana or something, and, you know, they settled around Grand Junction when he was in his teens. You know, he went to Vietnam, he was sort of a bit of a hellraiser, and, you know, had sort of a bad history with women, big drinker, big partier, and for all intents and purposes, it seems as though Linda Benson was sort of this, or her name was Linda Ketchum, before she took his last name, really settled him down. She was I sort of spent a lot of time while I was, reporting this, trying to sort of get a hold on her personality. And she seems to have been just a genuinely sweet young lady. I think, you know, she really had maybe the saddest life of anybody that I think I've ever, you know, not that I ever met her, but encountered. Just hearing stories about her, you know, her father died when she was 2. He dropped dead in a duck blind. They were from Nebraska. They moved to Colorado with Linda's stepmother, or her mother. I'm sorry, her mother and her stepfather, a guy named Lawrence Hemwright, who was a degenerate alcoholic and abusive to her when she was 16. Lawrence paid, her mother an ultimatum, basically saying it's either the kids or me. So she kicked the kids out of the house. There was abuse, you know. I mean, she just had her, a couple months before Linda died, her sister died of a strange drug overdose. And I think she was just a sweet, sad woman, 24-year-old stay-at-home mom. But yeah, I think she was just a sweet, sort of a sad woman. And I think she and Steve were just doing the best that they could.
Now, tell us a little bit about their family life there and their daughter, Kelly. And you can tell our audience how young he is.
Well,
talk about baby daughter. But also tell us a little bit about Grand Junction, where Grand Junction, Colorado really is geographically.
Okay, So their life was pretty quiet. They lived in a sort of an upscale apartment complex known as the Chateau Apartments. There were a lot of young families and a lot of college co-eds living around there. They lived in a second floor apartment that Steve paid for by working at as a pipe fitter at a power plant about, 4 or 5 hours north in Craig, Colorado. Grand Junction sits on the western slope of the Colorado. It's about, 25 minutes from the Utah line. It is a really a striking place. For much of the day, the entire atmosphere there sort of glows vermilion. There's the Colorado National Monument is there, and it is sort of mesa and butte and high desert for as far as the eye can see. It is a uniquely beautiful but also sort of spooky kind of place.
Right.
And it is, you know, historically been a boom town. There were, you know, they mined minerals there, vanadium, eventually uranium for the Manhattan Project. And there was a real sort of boom and bust mentality where you'd have a lot of young men moving into town, getting rich and then getting poor again even quicker. And I think 1975 in Grand Junction is sort of unique because, you know, you've got guys coming home from Vietnam. It seems like sort of oddly, everybody I spoke to had some story about a young man that they knew back then that died in a drunken wreck. You know, I think alcoholism was fairly rampant. It was also the sort of place where when men crossed each other, there was a fight. There was no sort of shoving. They just fought. You know, it was a lot of, you know, Steve Benson's dad and also Doug Rushing's dad, for that matter, were World War II vets and tough guys. You know, Doug Rushing's dad was in the 82nd Airborne. And so you had that generation of men who had had combat training, and then you had, you know, the next generation were young men who were, you know, going off to fight in Vietnam. So there was that sort of that, you know, that sort of tension of, like, having been in war, having been a soldier, you know, sort of, you know, kind of the widespread loss of, like, you know, white male privilege in terms of, you know, we're talking about a generation of guys who had sort of been betrayed by, or, you know, felt like they had been betrayed by the command structure in Vietnam. Women's lib was big, you know, sort of, we were on the, sort of the sexual revolution was sort of in full progress, and around town, you know, there was a Chicano movement was beginning to gather steam. So it's Grand Junction in 1975 is sort of a town that is small and yet growing, and also sort of seems to be a bit of a pressure cooker. In terms of crime.
Now you talk about Linda and Steve they had a lot of friends in the chateau building, but they really did spend most of their time. They were especially close with the Grants, Maureen Grant and Gary Grant and Gary Jr., who was mm-hmm. 3 years old, and they lived right above mm-hmm. them in apartment 311. So tell us a little bit about their relationship and how close they were, and tell us a little bit about Maureen and
well,
Gary
it was really,
and
it was,
relationship.
Yeah, it was really Linda and Maureen. Maureen was 19 when she moved to the chateau, you know, I think probably in the fall of 74. And Linda was really like a big sister to her. They, you know, their kids were about the same age. Gary Jr. was, you know, 3. Kelly was 5. So they spent, you know, their days at the park or... you know, sort of in the mornings they would go and they would take their kids for a walk, and then in the afternoon they would do yoga in one of the apartments. And they sort of, you know, since they lived sort of one on top of the other, you know, they would just keep their doors open and sort of run up and down the stairs. You know, they sort of had a schedule. On Tuesdays they went to, you know, Taco Bell. At Wednesdays they, you know, on Wednesdays they brought their kids to Friendly's. You know, there was always some sort of activity with the kids. And, you know, there was a strange thing was that these two women were very close, and yet their conversations a lot of the time sort of revolved around motherhood. You know, there wasn't a lot of kind of intense, intimate, personal talk about, you know, sort of about their lives. It was, you know, about sort of their lives beyond sort of the more quotidian details. You know, Linda had some other friends that I think she filled in more on that stuff, but Maureen is really the closest person to Linda at that time. And sort of, Gary Sr. worked out of town. I think he was a coal miner, up north, not far from where Steve worked, but they didn't really like Gary Sr. He was sort of abrasive, you know, again, sort of a boisterous drinker. So yeah, they had a really lively social life there. You know, a lot of sitting out on the patio, you know, a lot of beer drinking and sort of soft drugs and having fun.
Now, tell us about the situation where her husband is Steve is not home. When he works a little bit out of town. So, what's the situation
there?
They're not married, but tell us how it comes that he's not there all the time. We'll say.
So Steve works as he was a union pipe fitter at a big construction job. They were building a big powerhouse up in Craig, Colorado. So every Sunday at around 4 a.m., he would get out of bed and he would drive up to Craig with a guy named Harold Raley. They'd work the week. Steve would camp out, when it was warm enough, he would pop a tent out by Otter Creek, up by the Yampa River. And he would wake up in the morning and he'd fish for his breakfast, and then he'd go to work, and then he'd go back to his campsite and fish for his dinner. And he saved a lot of money doing that. During the winter, he would share a hotel room with, you know, 8 or 10 other guys, and they would split the bill 8 or 10 ways. He was really sort of working for the weekend, if you know what I mean. You know, like Linda and Kelly down in Grand Junction. So it was sort of, 4 days there, you know, 3 at home or something like that.
Now, was there any talk with Linda, with Maureen, about Steve being a threat at all? Was there any, I know they weren't, some of the conversation was limited, but was there any conversation like that with Maureen that Maureen had, was aware of?
You know, I not that I was aware of, you know, there's sort of the picture of, you know, it was interesting. The way my research shook out was I got in touch fairly early with the Grand Junction district attorney. They were really supportive. For my first 3 or 4 days in Grand Junction, they opened up a conference room in the courthouse building, and they just brought in all of the files, all of the photos, the crime scene photos, the autopsy photos, all of the police reports, all of the notes that the cops actually took back in 1975. Doug Rushing still had his stuff too, and he allowed me to take a look at that. But I just had an unbelievable amount of, you know, every time the police would interview somebody, they would fill out sort of an interview report. All the sort of the stuff that I read about, you know, kind of Steve's difficult history with women came from those police reports. You know, they came from exes or from people who knew an ex or something like that. By all accounts, you know, other than sort of from talking to Linda's family, I mean, they are sort of under the impression that Steve is the killer. I do not. By all accounts, it was sort of a loving, gentle relationship. You know, they were sort of, you know, like I said earlier, like two kids who were really kind of doing the best that they could. I don't think that Maureen or Linda's other kind of close confidant in the building there, her name was Pat Freeman, ever really thought of Steve that way. You know, I mean, I think certainly Pat had seen Steve lose his temper kind of in a drunken rage one night, but other than that, you know, they never heard of him, you know, sort of touching Linda in a way that she didn't want to be touched, or, you know, there were never, you know, bruise marks. I know the police didn't pull up any, you know, hospital reports for her with you know, a broken nose or a black eye or anything like that. So sort of from what I gather, it was kind of a quiet, gentle relationship.
Okay, let's talk about July 25th, 1975. Why is it that Steve doesn't have a key? Tell us the circumstances and the discovery that he makes.
So Steve was doing well enough at work that he wanted to buy a new El Camino, and he put down a deposit at the Chevy dealership in Craig, Colorado, and you know, after work that night, he dropped his Chevy Comet off at the dealership and caught a ride from Craig down to Grand Junction. About an hour outside of Grand Junction, he realizes that the keys that he'd left in the glove par, the glove box of the car that he was trading in also had his house key. So that when he arrived back to the chateau, he was locked out. And that sort of started I think must have been the most horrifying sort of 15 minutes of his life, where he's sort of, you know, realizing something's wrong and isn't able to, you know, get inside. And he, you know, began to ask the neighbors, you know, have you seen Linda? Where is she? You know, why is the apartment locked? Why, you know, why are the shades drawn? And, you know, eventually he was able to spring up on a sort of a swamp cooler that hung kind of, you know, about halfway between the second floor balcony and the ground. It was easy to kind of boost himself up off the swamp cooler and onto a balcony. And he was able to slide. There was a sliding door. He opened the sliding door was off the track. So he opened it, let himself in, and found the bodies there. And then, you know, went and called the police.
And what was the state, not to get into every gory detail, but what was the state of the bodies? Where were they in relation to each other, and what had happened to Linda and her little 5-year-old daughter?
So
daughter and wife.
In the hours that followed the discovery of the bodies, the Grand Junction police dispatched their crime scene unit to the apartment, and what they found was Linda had been stabbed and beaten pretty viciously, but she'd been stabbed mostly in the chest, in a kind of a cluster pattern over her heart, and her body was jammed up between a mattress, which they kept on the floor, and a bureau, and the space was just a little bit too small for her to fit into, so she was kind of pinned up against the wall or against the bureau a little bit. Kelly was in, there was sort of a strange hallway in the apartment, and Kelly was in there was the living room, and then you would walk through the living room into this hallway, and this hallway had doors for Steve and Linda's bedroom and then for a bathroom, and then the bathroom adjoined to Kelly's room, and Kelly was sort of halfway between the hallway and the bathroom, and she'd been stabbed in a sort of similar fashion, pretty brutally, I think 6 times.
Well, Steve, like you say, is shocked and runs out of there, but once police come there, what do they do with Steve? What is his state? What is his demeanor at that time? And how do police initially assess the crime scene?
Well, so Steve was brought down to the police station in question for quite a few hours. They did a physical examination, you know, they checking his hands, and he was eventually let go. You know, I think he was. I think the police sort of rightly assessed that he was in complete and total shock, and was also at the same time a little bit aggravated that the police were really kind of the police were looking him at, you know, at him as their primary suspect and made very little secret of that. Now the crime scene. There was a lot of blood, and there was blood in places that led the police to believe that the killer had cut himself. They found sort of bloody handprints on the wall in the living room by a light switch. They found, you know, drops of blood kind of all over the kitchen, and you know they found, you know, I mean, sort of. This is sort of blood in addition to kind of like your average kind of cast-off spray. So, you know, so they had a pretty good idea. There were sort of, you know, two plump droplets on Linda's chest that, you know, led the police to believe that, you know, the killer had sort of leaned down over her and bled on her. And so they, you know, seeing that, they kind of immediately tried to type, you know, they took scrapings of the blood for typing. So they also took blood from Steve Benson, too, to match up, to see if they could match it up with the blood test. Still, you know, I'm fairly certain that if you were to talk to Doug Rushing or with Jim Fromm, the two detectives that investigated, I think they would tell you that fairly early on they didn't think that it was Steve Benson. excuse me. I know Fromm told me on a number, I'm sorry, not Fromm, Rushing told me on another on a number of occasions that, you know, one of the things that they learned at the police academy in Golden, you know, years earlier, was that most of the time when the bodies are just sort of left at the crime scene, it's not a family member. Family members will try to, or the theory that they were using were that sort of family members try to dispose of the bodies. They try to hide what they've done. You know, maybe it's out of shame, but, you know, they thought, you know, kind of family members will frequently, you know, take the bodies away and try to hide them someplace.
Was there some element of, you alluded to the idea that it might be something on the chest of both Linda and her daughter. Was it a cross, as you mentioned? Was it determined to be a cross?
It wasn't on Kelly's chest, but there was a cross. It looked like it was done with the tip of a very sharp knife, sort of carved into Linda's chest. And you know, sort of at the autopsy, the forensic doctor noted that he thought she had been tortured.
Now, what do police determine from? Is there a robbery motive? Was Linda sexually assaulted? Does it look? Again, we just talked about that. It looks not like a family member because the bodies weren't covered up, and then there's this obvious overkill, and now you're talking about torture. So what could the police deem from the crime scene? What was their earliest conclusions, at least their ideas about
all along? They consistently, nothing was taken from the apartment. They did a walkthrough with Steve Benson days after the murder. They brought him back to the crime scene, and he did a walkthrough. And they basically determined, based on the condition of her body, and you know that she had a lot of material under a lot of skin, you know, skin and material under her fingernails. What they think happened was that it was an attempted rape. That the assailant had entered the apartment and tried to rape her, and she fought him off, and he ended up killing her. And you know, because this happened late at night, the struggle woke up the little girl who went out into the living room and saw this strange man in her house and, you know, made a racket and he killed her. I think as far as I can tell, that's actually what happened, you know? And that for the most part was their theory sort of from the start. You know, nothing had been stolen. Steve Benson's alibi was really airtight. You know, there were time cards. There was not a lot of, you know, there were time cards. There were witnesses who saw him up around Hayden, Colorado, kind of hours earlier. There was no real solid reason to think it was Steve Benson other than, what people were saying about Benson around town. And just the fact that, you know, they always look at the spouse first. And so I think the police's or the sort of Grand Junction police's assessment of what happened in that apartment from the beginning was fairly consistent, and to this day I think is actually what happened.
Now tell our audience, as you point out in the book, there's for those people that are not quite as old as I am, in my 50s, so tell us about what the state of forensic technology was and science was in regards to DNA at that time. But regardless of that, what was police procedure in terms of preserving evidence at the crime scene?
Sure. So, yeah, no DNA technology yet to speak of. I don't think that they actually, the suspect, the guy they eventually get, they get him because of a blood test that he gives up in prison in 1978. I don't think sort of DNA testing was getting going, kind of until around that time. The forensic science in the mid-70s, I think they did a good job. The Grand Junction Police Department clearly did a very good job with the technology that they had available to them. So they were doing serology, which is, blood typing. But that was kind of about it. They could do fingerprints, but that was really, that was still a really time-consuming and frequently fruitless, discipline. So, yeah, I mean, it was really just blood typing, blood typing and kind of on-the-ground police work.
Now, you say that Steve Benson has got an airtight alibi, despite what the city folk believe or despite what the media has conjured up. But then you also, in this tale, include other people and other victims as you introduce Detective Rushing and Detective Fromm. And so let's talk a little bit about 24-year-old Denise Oliverson, and tell us why her case is important to this story.
Well, so 1975 in the Midwest, in the West, the kind of from really from Oregon to Arizona is terrifying. Girls were just disappearing left and right, and nobody knew where they were going, or what was happening to them. Occasionally some jogger in a park would find some a skull or some bones, or a girl would wash up in a river and she'd been tortured and killed, a terrifying time to live in the West. And Oliverson is this sort of, she was, 24 and newly married, I think. And she'd had a fight with her husband, took her bike out, and was last seen at a gas station where, kind of months later they discover Ted Bundy used his credit card there that afternoon. Bundy is really sort of a catalyst for just a feeling of, just this sort of feeling of fear, that, he was grabbing girls everywhere, and there was just that atmosphere. People were scared. This was truly 1975, truly kind of the era of the drifter. There was no real way of, people, kind of keeping tabs on each other. There are no cell phones. There are no real computers. It's not like the police are going to, instantaneously be able to trace credit card receipts or, ATM use or anything like that. And that's really what Ted Bundy was doing around that time, was sort of going on these hunting expeditions around, Colorado and Utah. And so he's sort of part of that. Grand Junction also sits on Interstate 70. It's the largest city between Salt Lake and Denver, so it's a major thoroughfare for all sorts of unsavory guys who are passing, passing through town. I think that year, was it two or three of the 10 of the FBI's most wanted were caught around, on or around I-70. There was a large transient population. I mean, it was a really, like I said before, it was a small town that was bracing for an oil shale boom. There was sort of an influx of new money, and just people started showing up in town, and nobody really knew who any of these new people were. They were transients. Like I said, there were sort of truck drivers and all these people sort of stopping off and mixing with the locals, and, you know, every so often there'd be, you know, a big bar fight or, you know, a stabbing. You know, things were really sort of about to go bad there.
Now, you talk about in your book that the extent that the police in Grand Junction went, to the extent that they went to try to find the perpetrators of these murders. And so they looked at peeping Toms and flashers and stalkers and prank callers and sex offenders. Tell us what the police rushings and Fromm and the police force do. What's their next step? And what is the extent, as I alluded to try to find the perpetrators?
Yeah, I mean, they did hundreds of interviews. I mean, they really left no stone went unturned. They went as far as they had the chief of detectives flew to Quantico to meet with the FBI, and they did the behavioral analysis unit was a kind of a new thing in 1975, and so the chief of detectives went to Quantico to spend a week with the behavioral analysis unit, and he came back with a sort of generic sketch of a mannequin, horny 17-year-old with, associative disorder, or attachment disorder or something, they were looking for a young man who, did not like being in the boys' locker room after gym and, was into pornography and had maybe set fires and had maybe tortured animals, somebody would have tattoos or, they thought, they were looking for somebody who maybe worshipped Satan. You know, they sort of this laundry list of, one of the investigators would later call it sad scientific wild-ass guesses, they just didn't have the technology to solve this case at their disposal. There was really nothing that they could have done. I'm not sure that I'm giving up too much by saying, one of those drifters that I was talking about was involved. There was literally nothing else that they could have done. I mean, they just were not getting an answer then.
There was the idea that you had mentioned that they thought that the perpetrator had cut himself and serious enough that they notified all the surrounding hospitals to be on the alert for somebody that might have wounded them. What was their progress or what was their success in that lead?
Again, nothing. I mean, there was a guy who had cut himself building an enclosure for his chickens. I think on some roofing he'd cut his hand. There was a young guy who cut himself working at a steakhouse. There was a guy who got a pencil point through the outside of his hand when he was wrestling with a friend. They just had nothing. They went after Linda's father-in-law, a guy named Lawrence Hemmerite, who was, as I mentioned earlier, kind of a degenerate and an alcoholic, and he had sexually abused Linda when she was young. And they couldn't, they couldn't get anything on him. Like, he would lie about his alibi, but then there was just nothing. There was nothing that they could put on him. Rushing said to me once, you can't lock a guy up for just being an asshole.
Yeah.
And they just had nothing, they wanted him. They wanted it to be him, I think, really badly. He was a really good suspect, and they just didn't have the evidence. They had all this sort of blood evidence, there was a droplet of blood from the crime scene that was on the outside of a Chex box that was just a perfect sample of, perfect sample, perfectly placed. They found it, there was just no way to match it. This case just really needed DNA.
Now, in your book, you talk about young girls turning up dead everywhere in the western United States, Washington, Utah, Colorado, found naked, frozen out in the woods, raped, beaten, mutilated, strangled, skulls caved in. And the other women had vanished, and so there was no body. So there was dozens of girls. So what is tell us about Agent Bob Perkins and the connection with Junction and what they do with this sort of information that they're getting from these other states about missing women and murdered women.
So I think Bob Perkins had just noticed that all of these girls that were missing kind of looked alike. You know, they were all, you know, late teens, pretty, long dark hair that they parted down the middle. And he started, so this is actually sort of funny. When I was reporting this, I would talk to Junction, to Rushing and Fromm about law enforcement then, and Doug made it clear to me that even in 1975, the phrase serial killer wasn't really being used at all anywhere. And Perkins just noticed that these girls all looked alike, you know, and they were all sort of, you know, the ones who were recovered were, you know, the same thing. They had all died in sort of a similar manner, you know, brutally. And he started to formulate this theory that, you know, all of these deaths were connected, and that, you know, that suspicion sort of links up with accounts of this guy named Ted who's driving, you know, a tan Beetle around the, you know, around the western states grabbing girls. You know, there had been a couple of Bundy's potential victims got away and gave, you know, police reports. And I think it was one of Bundy's ex-girlfriends that had first, you know, reported really, really bizarre activity. I think maybe it was in Washington State or Utah, maybe. And so they knew sort of in theory about this guy, Ted. And he was really, I think, the harbinger of bad things in Junction. He grabbed Denise Oliverson on April 24th.
Now, what was the Rushing and Fromm's reaction to, you know, Ted Bundy being a potential culprit in Linda Benson's murder and her daughter, Kelly? How far did they go? And tell us about their investigation into that.
Yeah, you know, Linda's, you know, the sort of, it's strange, you know, The Bundy struck in Grand Junction in April, and they concluded, you know, as the Bundy investigation wore on, as they sort of started collecting good intelligence on him, you know, after he was stopped in Salt Lake, kind of, I think that was in the fall, maybe August or September, and they sort of started put the, you know, there was a kind of regional call to arms amongst police departments about this guy Ted and where he'd been and what he'd done. And as they started to look for him, Bob, you know, Rushing and Fromm, remembering that Bob Perkins had sort of like pointed to all of these girls who sort of looked the same, like, you know, Linda Benson, like Denise Oliverson, you know, pretty brown hair, long, that they parted in the middle. Fromm and Rushing definitely checked on Bundy's whereabouts on the night of the murders, and there was just no way that it could have been Bundy. He was another one that was actually fairly easy to eliminate. I think it was based on credit card records.
It is incredible, though, that's where Bundy was on April 6th, and yet he was not the killer of these two women. That is, and you're talking about a place that's, what, 20,000 people?
Yeah, I think it was about 25,000 people. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, and he, you know, he, I think he struck in, what was it, in Telluride, in Aspen. I think he grabbed a girl in Snowmass, which is not far from Grand Junction at all. Yeah, he was definitely that area, you know, that I-70 corridor, you know, it's Denver to Salt Lake in a couple hours. And there's really not much, you know, there's Grand Junction and there are sort of a couple, resort towns along the way, but really, really not much. Aspen, you know, Telluride's not far, but yeah, it's kind of amazing. I mean, just all of the, all of the, just the concentration of evil around that time in that place is really staggering. It really is.
Absolutely. So, Rushing and Fromm are, again, hard at work at trying to find who is the culprits. How do police proceed? We're talking
about Rushing and Fromm, a lot of time.
Yeah, they're actually
really sort of interesting characters, you know, sort of in the tradition of, you know, true crime or sort of, I had been reading a lot of, I think I mentioned this to you earlier, I had been reading a lot of Cormac McCarthy at the time and also a lot of sort of hard-boiled writing. So I was sort of like really thinking about like two traditions and sort of, you know, the Western and, or, you know, sort of the Border Trilogy books and also sort of, you know, old detective novels. You know, I was reading the David Peace, I read the David Peace trilogy, right around that time too. And the thing that I love about Rushing and Fromm as characters is that they're both, you know, when this happened, they were both detectives, but they were still both like 23 and 24 years old. So they were really, you know, they were kids, they were children. And they were, I was sort of trying to operate in this, you know, the tradition of like, you know, the hard boiled, detective novel, but these guys were just like the softest boiled guys there ever were, you know, like, you know, Jim was like a wealthy kid who's, you know, whose dad belonged to the local golf club, and Doug, you know, was sort of had a dad that was, you know, a bad alcoholic and really violent, and Doug really sort of depended on his mom and his sisters, and, you know, to this day, he's a really soft-spoken, very sweet, very sensitive guy, and so, you know, it was sort of fun to interact with those characters and sort of like try to understand how two completely innocent 23-year-old kids are dealing with this, you know, with these murders. And I really truly believe that they were really trying to just get by. You know, I think they were really just trying to survive. They ran down, you know, every lead there was. I mean, I think that they were two very different guys. You know, Doug is sort of soft-spoken, and Fromm is sort of, to this day, is sort of has a real chip on his shoulder. And they were, you know, they complemented each other well. You know, Fromm's the first guy to sort of, like, knock down the door, but Rushing wants to hang around a lot longer and sort of like look at evidence, or he always wants to do the extra interview. You know, he was a really thorough, very thoughtful, very analytical cop. And they really, you know, they ran it out to the end. Fromm told me the day that he knew that they weren't going to catch him was the day that they were given a new profile of the killer. And they were interviewing men between the ages of 18 and 41 who got pornographic materials sent to their house. And on the top of the list was, like, Fromm's best friend, who was just this really, you know, gentle guy who there was no way that he had killed Linda Benson, just no way, and he knew it. And he, you know, that was just sort of the end point for them, you know, that was that afternoon that they realized they were never going to catch this guy, that he was just going to walk free and get away with it.
And sure enough, this case goes.
Yeah, it went cold. It really went cold, kind of about a month and a half after the bodies were discovered or so, you know, a month and a half, after that, you know, Jim and Doug sort of stopped working, you know, 18-hour days and, you know, started playing golf again.
Yeah. Now tell us briefly about the Ken Botham trial. Who's Ken Botham, and why is this part of the story as well, and how?
Well, you know, I mean, So Ken Botham was a really intelligent, super intelligent fellow who lived in town. By all accounts, sort of a super intelligent, really arrogant guy who worked as a film producer, I believe. And he lived with his wife, Patricia, and their two boys. The younger one is Thad. I can't recall the name of the older boy. And they lived on Ouray Avenue, not far from the Chateau Apartments. They lived across the street from a young woman who was in her early 20s and had two boys. Her name was Linda Miracle. And I think it was in mid-August, about a month or so, after the Benson gals turned up dead, Pat Botham, along with Linda Miracle and the Miracle boys, vanished. And just, nobody knew where they went. I mean, sort of, it was clear that they were snatched from Linda's house. There was food still on the table, and I think one of the burners on the stove was still going. But they didn't know where these two women had vanished to. They sort of thought, Pat Botham is, very unhappily married. Maybe they all took off. But, there were weird things like Pat Botham's kids were still there, and so were her glasses and her cigarettes, and one of her shoes was still there. Like things that people presumably would take with them if they were, bailing on an unhappy marriage were still in the house. And so missing, there was never ruled a homicide, no bodies, no body, no homicide, until the bodies were found, I think 6 or 7 weeks later, maybe, I think late October.
Right.
And, there was just an orgy of evidence pointing to Ken Botham, blood on his car, when the bodies were recovered, the hands were bound with a pretty heavy gauge wire. Yeah. And so they found matches on wire cutters and wire. But again, what I really wanted to do with this book, and with with Bundy and with the Botham cases, I'm really just trying to create atmosphere, it's atmosphere. There was a lot of talk around town that all of these murders were linked together. Why else would all of these young women be going missing? They have to be connected. If it's not Bundy, it's got to be somebody else. And what's going on that all of these women are disappearing? And so somehow Fromm and Rushing end up investigating this Botham case. And to this day, Botham has since been, Mr. Botham has since been twice convicted of these murders. And to this day, there's a large faction of people around town that are absolutely sure that he's innocent, that it was somebody else who did the killing.
Now, just to throw even more of a monkey wrench into this story and to add sort of, again, I think part of your story is, too, that nobody knows who anyone really is, and that's why when people point fingers, it looks like there might be a logical suspect, but it turns out that they're not at all. So there is a lot.
Yeah, everybody's a red herring. Yeah, everybody's a suspect, and nobody's done it. It's just, there are sort of a number of other young women around town who, after the Botham disappearances, and after all that's going on, more women are disappearing, and there another girl sort of in December is found strangled in her bathtub. And they don't know, and they never find that guy either. It's just there was no relief. Even sort of, I sort of often feel like, like an arrest justice is something that frequently will offer relief, and there was just no relief like that either. I think the police department really almost lost control of the town. The people were so scared. And I think in a lot of ways, that's what I really wanted the first half of this book to be about, is sort of a town unraveling.
Sure.
And that certainly happens. you know, and sort of that real feeling of fear around town sort of pervades until the middle of like 1976, or sort of fall of 76 when Mr. Botham is convicted.
One other thing is that a guy named Steve Goad in 1976 or so, and this doesn't come out till a little bit later, but he sees something about Ted Bundy on TV and sees Bundy's face, and at that time says, later on he says, I recognize that guy, and I saw him at the chateau. So tell us a little bit about just this little part of the story that you
have. Yeah, you know, it's funny. So Steve Goad was this sort of a... he's still a character. He was one of the guys I found, and he had a roommate. And these guys were sort of they were making a lot of money tending bar at a local local club, and they were really into like racing hot rods. And they, Goad and his buddy Clint, were in the parking lot at the chateau one night, and they saw a guy. You know, it was the night that when the Benson's murdered, they see a guy sort of like leave the apartment building, and you know, it looked like he was sort of like, you know, sort of clutching at his hand or something. And Goad gave him a good look in the eye, and the way Goad put it to me, he said, I thought we were going to rumble. Like, the guy just was scary looking and looked at him very aggressively. So I think he waited like six months or 8 months to contact the police with this. And he was sure that it was Ted Bundy. The funny thing was that, that testimony was largely dismissed because there was some information that Steve was sort of like, God, what's the phrase for this? Like, visually unreliable. Like, he had once claimed to see an airplane crash on a golf course. And swore that he saw this airplane crash on a golf course, but no airplane ever crashed on a golf course in Grand Junction. So they were just sort of like, you know, this guy's Fruit Loops. You know, he's sort of nuts.
Yeah.
His testimony was eventually dismissed. But yeah, I mean, they ran down everything. I mean, and it seemed like the Benson case, which was officially closed in 76. Every couple of years, somebody would come forward and claim to know something, and they would, you know, there was, one of Linda's mom, Barbara, had a husband. She had several husbands. I think she'd been married like 8 or 9 times, but she had one of her sort of many husbands came to the police in like 79 or 80 and said, I think Barbara did it. You know, it was always sort of, you know, it was always sort of being opened and shut, and, you know, they'd look into it, or, you know, there'd be a lead and they'd go and get the boxes. But yeah, sort of strangely, they never got their guy.
Now let's talk about the change of guard at the Grand Junction, Colorado police in terms of the reinvestigation. Are they going to reopen? They get some money from Colorado, from the state of Colorado, to open up some cold cases. And who opens up the cold cases, and how do they proceed? Tell us about this.
Yeah, I think it was essentially, federal money that had been given to the state during stimulus, during the Great Recession. And it was money that the department could never actually figure out a way to spend it. So they gave it to the departments to open up cold cases. And so what they did was they called in, you know, a lot of these old cops had stayed around, guys that had you know, sort of headed up the department in the 70s, had stayed around Grand Junction, especially a guy named Ron Smith, who was kind of the chief of detectives, and he ran a kind of a private detective agency after retirement, and you know, all these guys talk. It's a really small, really tight-knit community as is. But they came to him and they said, you know, we've got this federal money, and we're sort of, you know, we're looking for a cold case to investigate. Does anything sort of strike you as appropriate? And he said, oh yeah, you know, the Benson case. They asked another. The police asked another retired detective, he gave them the same answer. You know, they got to Rushing and Fromm, and they gave him the same answer. So it was very clear early on that there was going to be a lot of evidence that maybe they could use. I think it was right around Thanksgiving of 2008 or so, they called in a guy named Larry Bullard. And if there was ever a gentleman who is made and crafted by the Lord to be a law enforcement agent, it was this guy. I mean, he is, you know, sort of big strawberry blonde guy with, you know, sort of fists like hammers and huge forearms and a thundering voice and a, you know, gigantic mustache. And he had been, the head of forensics and, at a police department in New Mexico for years and years and years before retiring and moving to Grand Junction and starting a second career in law enforcement. And he just ended up being the perfect person to spearhead this thing. He took all these boxes of evidence, all the exhibits, all the notes, and, organized and digitized things and really recreated that, the investigation from 1975, that Fromm, Rushing, and the sort of other small team of detectives that worked with them put together for the Benson case. Eventually, as he was getting to the end of his own investigation, but they got, that's when the DNA match came back. And so it really worked neatly for them, in terms of, the timing that, Bullard finishes his investigation. He sort of has come to the same conclusion that the cops in 75 did, that there was just nobody, it didn't make sense that anybody around town did this. Everybody had sort of these buttoned up alibis, that finally they get sort of, they get the results on the DNA test, and it was just somebody they never suspected.
Now, let's talk about Jerry Nemnich, because that's who they get through CODIS, and it's a match, and you alluded to that his DNA was in the system since 78. Tell us what his illustrious career criminal life was, and then tell us who Sandy Higgins is and how they came to speak to Sandy Higgins.
Yeah, so Jerry was just a bad guy. I think wicked is really the only word for him. Got caught for his first rape when he was 15. I think he did, five or six years for that first offense. And on the very day that he was released, he was picked up again and extradited to Colorado for a rape that he committed like a day or two after his first assault. And he pled guilty and went away again for, another 7 years, and then, sort of drifted around and ended up in Grand Junction and was passing bad checks and did another 4 years. And it was just sort of, he was just in and out over and over again. I can't think of anything to say about him other than he was just a really rotten character. During my research, I actually uncovered a really sort of, probably a 300 or 400 page stack of letters that he had exchanged with a woman after he was put back in jail in 1978 for a rape and attempted murder. And he, these letters are just, it's just sort of kind of like a map of a psychopath's mind. They're sort of fascinating. He's a guy who sort of in his life has never really done anything and has a really, high opinion of himself, and nothing is ever his own fault. And, there are sort of all of these really bad sexual innuendos, and just really a guy who's clearly not comfortable with who he is. And he's, you can tell he's lonely and he's desperate, and, you can sort of, every once in a while you sort of like, he'll write something and it gives you a glimpse of sort of like, you're sort of reminded like, oh, this guy is a serial rapist. He was just a, yeah, I mean, a really bad guy. I think in 74 he was released from prison for passing some bad checks, and he met a woman in Denver named Sandy Higgins. Sandy was a divorcee who had moved to Grand Junction, I think from like around Chicago maybe. And she had a waitressing job, and she met Jerry at a nightclub, and they just sort of fell in together. She lived really hard, you know, and I think they were sort of, you know, they were sort of a mess together. You know, I think they were, in a lot of ways, it seems like they were kind of perfect for each other, and just that they really were kind of a mess together. You know, there was, you know, like a lot of boozing that went on. So, you know, Jerry found a job at a print shop in Grand Junction. And then after Grand Junction, they were in California for a while, and they were back in Denver. And then they were sort of, I think he went up to work in the oil patch in like Wyoming or Idaho. She went with him until eventually they broke up. And then he committed another rape, and he was in jail again from, gosh, I think it was from 78 to like 98 or so. Or 76 to 98. Yeah. When he was released.
So it was crucial. Tell us about how hard it was or not hard it was getting the information from Sandy Higgins about the night that, despite this DNA evidence, they need a little bit more evidence. And this certainly is a lot more evidence in terms of him coming to the home and what she witnessed. So tell us about that and how hard or easy it was to get that information from Sandy Higgins.
Sure. So the Grand Junction police, they convened a little cold case unit to work on this case together. And besides Larry Bullard, you know, Larry Bullard sort of took the case to the conclusion that he could, which was that nobody in Grand Junction committed the murders. Then they had the DNA evidence that came in. It proved that this guy, Jerry Nemnick, who was this drifter, was the culprit. And what the police then needed to do was they needed to figure out if Jerry Nemnick was ever in Grand Junction at that time, where he lived, to see if there was any sort of proximity to the Benson place, if he had known Linda Benson, and what was the connection, because they didn't have a murder weapon. So they needed all this. They also needed a DNA sample to test against the sample that they had from 1978 and to test against the samples that were taken from under Linda's fingernails and from the bread on the cereal box. And so they dispatched these two detectives, Crockett and Bennett, both really great guys from Grand Junction. And these guys start traveling the United States, tracking down people who were friends with Jerry in the 70s. And they got those names through looking at the visitors' logs at the prisons where Jerry had done time, and just sort of then by word of mouth. So they, you know, and they sort of worked in these circles. So at the center of the circle was Jerry, and since they didn't want to, they didn't want to tip him off about the investigation, they started on the outside of the circle, which is a sort of a common device or sort of a common strategy that a lot of journalists like Bob Woodward would use. And so they sort of started circling Jerry. And so the first round of people that they wanted to talk to were the ones who were sort of farthest from him. So it was actually, they started by talking with the women that he had raped in the past and sort of figured out what was his MO. And then they eventually, they talked to some other people that sort of knew Jerry in the 70s. And then just when they thought that they were getting a little too close, that's when they got their arrest warrant and brought Nemnick in. So after they brought Nemnick in, they had him in custody, that's when they got on the road and they started talking to people that they knew were really close with Nemnick in the 70s. And eventually they get to this sort of little town. Was it Winnetka? Is that where Sandy's from?
Yes.
Sort of on the border of Illinois and Indiana. And she lives in this sort of scrappy old house, and she's clearly a very scrappy old lady. They could smell the cats from outside. And she just had just very little memory. I mean, I think it had sort of been erased by a life of boozing. And she just was not really able to recall anything at first. And then, you know, they thought, I think Bennett and Crocker going into that interview had thought that that was going to be the one that sort of wrapped it up for them. Oh yeah, you know, we knew Linda Benson from X, or, you know, Jerry took him to like to her because why, or yeah, we used to have threesomes with the Bensons, or there, you know what I mean? There would be something, some recognition of the name. You know, this interview was going to yield some result for them, and Sandy didn't remember anything until the next morning when she calls Bennett on his cell phone and says, you know, I do remember Jerry having an injury. He came home one night, and I remember because he was wearing my favorite, he had these sherbet yellow nylon pants that I used to love on him, and they were covered in blood. And then she says, you know, and then the next day we took off to Denver. And so they, you know, I think, Crocker and Bennett then go to, Rhode Island, and they find the guy that Jerry and Sandy had stayed with in Denver. And it turned out that, you know, Sandy could never remember the address where they lived in, right, because they were trying to establish proximity. And so the guy that they were staying with in Denver was this guy named George, who had worked in a liquor store. And Jerry had passed two bad checks in this liquor store. And the guy, George, who worked behind the counter and was putting Jerry up, had saved these checks for 34 years just because he was positive that he was going to encounter Jerry Nemnick at some other point in his life and wanted to be like, I want my $50. So, I mean, and on these checks, Jerry had scribbled out their address in Denver and had written on the checks 2850 Texas Avenue, Grand Junction, Colorado. And Crockett, seeing that, immediately knew that 2850 Texas is a little trailer on a sort of on a corner and a pretty nice little development, like a pretty nice little trailer park. You know, it's like it's clean,
right.
You know, and it's about a mile and a half from the chateau. And Crockett knew it. That was sort of like one of the big moments for them, that they had proximity. It's a sort of about, you know, maybe like a mile and an eighth, you know, the Nemnick residence in the chateau. And that was really one of the things that I think sealed the deal for those guys was getting that address. Coincidentally, you know, sort of some of the police, one place where sort of the police department had failed was there was an old cop named Wilcox that lived right across the street from Jerry and Sandy. And he said that, you know, there was screaming and fighting and sort of labored noises coming from the Nemnick residence all the time. And Wilcox just never looked into Jerry. I mean, it never occurred to him, even after he saw him with a bandage on the hand, to look into him.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah.
Now, we have to talk about the trial a little bit, and which is very, very unusual, as you know, is that Nemnick takes the stand. So tell us just a little bit about the trial, but especially Nemnick taking the stand.
Well, Nemnick or Nemnick, I always sort of say Nemnick. I think that the pronunciation goes either way. He was represented by a really, really skilled defense team from Denver. You know, Doug Rushing said to me sort of years later that he thought Nemnick was going to get off. You know, that his defense team had created just enough doubt that he thought that the jury might buy it. And then Nemnick takes the stand and gives just sort of the most outrageously, really just the most outrageous testimony in the history of perjury. I mean, just really just unbelievable. He claims that, like, you know, he's at the bar one night and he gets talking to what is it, like a 6'7" Indian, and he can't tell if this Indian is male or female, and the Indian says, "Oh, hey, will you take me to get a little marijuana?" And so they go to the chateau, and then the guy disappears, and he waits around, and he's got to pee, so he goes into the chateau hallway to look for this 6'7" Indian, but he doesn't see him, but he does see that there's a door open, and it happens to be the door where Linda and Kelly are. And just as he walks in, he sees a figure who he can't tell if that figure is male or female coming at him with a knife raised over his head. And Jerry's got to fight the knife out of his hand, and he does. The guy drops the knife and runs out of the apartment, and Jerry picks up the knife and throws it in the kitchen. That's how the blood got everywhere. And then he can see, the bodies from sort of that kitchen area, which is actually an impossibility because of the weird hallway that I was talking about earlier. The bodies were blocked from view. And so he has this just really the most porous testimony ever, and is convicted. Was convicted fairly quickly. I think that jury spent a lot of time sort of going over things, and kind of reviewing all of the evidence because they wanted to get it done right. But in the end, I don't think there was ever much question that his testimony was just ridiculous.
Yeah. Now, what would you say in terms of, you write in the epilogue about the story itself, but what did you come away from this story, The Killing Season? What was the most profound, I guess, effect, or what really struck you, I think, after writing this book?
What struck me was, for me, it's all about Fromm and Rushing, for some reason. In the years since those murders, Steve Benson disappeared, and sort of has lived his life entirely off the grid. He exists largely as kind of a hermit around the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico, what struck me is just the way that these murders 35 years ago have just utterly destroyed lives. Steve Benson has been sort of hiding from this. And I don't think I'm not saying that he's been hiding from it because he's guilty of it. I think that what happened to him, finding those people who were, the two people in the world that he loved the most, so utterly wrecked him that he had to run away, Linda's family, Linda's stepsister and her little brothers, like Linda's stepsister was just absolutely ruined by this. She lost her mind. She had problems for years and years and years. Linda's mother too, who I she lost two daughters. Like I feel for her. Not a great impact. She was not a woman who had a really profoundly positive impact on her daughter's life, but nonetheless, no parent deserves to lose somebody that way. And then for Rushing and Fromm, who I think, Doug told me that he went to one of those Dale Carnegie conferences. They had one at the Holiday Inn, in Grand Junction or in Golden, a couple of years back. And he got to thinking about, there was a question that he had to answer during one of the exercises, which was, if you think really honestly with yourself, what is the most profound thing that has ever happened to you? Like, what is the thing that has changed your view of the world most? And he thought and he thought and he thought, and Rushing couldn't think of anything that had happened to him that was more important than that case. Same with Fromm. He quit the force or was sort of, asked to leave the force shortly after those murders, or not too long after those murders. And he, opened up and has had a pretty successful run as an accountant. But again, you know, he would find himself thinking about that case. What did we do wrong? What did we miss? You know, what didn't we find? What could we have done better? Over and over again for 30 plus years. And then finally there's some relief. You know, I mean, for me, it was always about sort of that kind of redemption. You know, like, I'm not sure Steve Benson's ever going to get better or he's ever going to feel better about what happened to him. But, like, at least that part of his life is over now. You know, at least he can do something else. And the same thing with Rushing and Fromm. You know, at least those guys can rest easy on that now. You know, I think the thing that I got most out of it was just sort of that feeling of relief and that redemption for those people.
Yeah, it's an incredible tale of how much misery and tragedy one small area can endure and be touched by this, just incredible evil for such a small area for a time that we don't think of 1975 as the good old days, but it was a more innocent time, and yet the evil that was present in this area over a good period of years, and then, like you say, a 35-year cold case cast a pall on a neighborhood and a community as well, too. So,
sure.
Incredible story.
Sure.
For those that might want to contact you, do you do Facebook? Do you have a website? Tell us how people might.
I do Facebook, or I'm on Twitter. If you want to reach out to me directly, you can reach me on my email is french.alex.m@gmail.com.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Alex, for coming on and talking about The Killing Season. Incredible story, and thank you for this interview.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, I hope to talk to you again sometime soon, and thank you, and have a great evening. Good night.
You too. Bye-bye.